was produced by Snarf Dude and Daffodil, but was originally created by Snarf Dude and Moondog for Scottsdale and Productions. Drop by the website anytime online at www.chezepleeze.com. I'm Uncle Skeeter, inviting you back next week as we help to spread the cheese.
Hi, this is Towers, and you're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM in Burnaby, BC. Diverse, independent, yours.
Welcome to Scream Therapy. I'm your host, Jason Schurz. In October of 2018, I found myself in the hospital, sitting across from a psychiatrist who was telling me I had bipolar. I was sent home with a bunch of medication and laid on the couch for a week. I had my iTunes library on shuffle, trying to shake the hornet's nest from my head. Ever since I was a kid, I've been using loud music as a form of therapy. Punk rock and mental health have always been connected. This podcast looks at that connection through the lens of different guests. This is Scream Therapy. It's well known that depression and creativity are intrinsically linked. Like a cruel yin and yang, the roadblocks that come with low moods often fuel the creative expression when the fog lifts. Hank Atherton of self-proclaimed heavy gaze band, Male Gaze, that's male... gaze, says when he's not active with music, he falls into a depression which began when he was a teenager. Hank has played in as many bands as he can over the years, but it was the downtimes that snowballed into isolation and lack of motivation. As Hank has learned about how his depression presents itself and affects his day-to-day, he's been able to manage it and center his love for playing music. It turns out, what makes you happy is the best medicine.
My name's Hank Atherton. I play guitar and do backup vocals for Male Gaze. Been playing music pretty much all my life, since working with my grandpa's bands when I was really young and then getting into punk and emo music when I was in my early teens. Music and mental health have been fully intertwined in my life ever since I was a teenager, being diagnosed with depression. Noticed I'd go into these pretty extreme spirals when I didn't have that creative outlet. And so that creative outlet has been pretty much a critical part to me, like living a fulfilling life, as it turns out. And I think that link between music and my depression has been pretty much exclusively about like finding fulfillment and not feeling like just a person floating around in the world, because it can be really easy to feel like your existence is just like a series of repetitive motions. But when you have something that brings you some joy and fulfillment and gives your life that kind of meaning, you can find a better way through.
For me, there's times in my life where I have had those gaps in creative expression. And I do find that I really suffer during those times. First of all, let's talk a bit about what kind of music you've done over the years and how you got into it. And maybe later we'll chat about, you know, what it's looked like in your life when you didn't have those expressive outlets. So when did you first get into music? You mentioned a little bit about that.
Yeah, so I was really fortunate to kind of grow up in a household that had a lot of music around. My grandpa plays in a band that he's been doing since right before I was born, or like immediately after, where he would go around with his coworkers at the time, and then church friends would go play at like assisted living facilities in the region. Just play for the old folks, you know, play a bunch of old covers and stuff. And when I was like 5 or 6, he would drag me along as a roadie. So I'd be like coiling cables and hauling mic stands and stuff like that. And as I got older and more interested in it, I'd start helping with the actual like mixing and audio production of it. And then once I started actually playing, I was in the band. So I've been playing with him since I was 12, and I'm still doing it, which is kind of crazy. In my mid-30s now, we're still at it. Smaller scale. So I've been doing that kind of stuff for a while, and like that kind of got me into playing with a band, which I think a lot of people, when they're first learning, when they're young, don't have that opportunity as much. They, you know, are practicing on their own. And so when they finally get into a room with other people, it's like, well, okay, what do we do now? Right. But I was very fortunate to have that growing up. And then when I was in high school, I joined, I coerced my way into my first band, as many often do. They needed a bass player and I play bass. I'm like, well, I should just play bass for you guys. And they were like, okay, sure, you're here now. But that was like it was a very Taking Back Sunday inspired emo band.
That moment of finding that first style of music, and a lot of the folks that I talked to on the podcast, you know, they have that, whether it's My Chemical Romance or Green Day or that one band that kind of jumps out at them. And for you, was it Taking Back Sunday or was it a different band?
You know, it's funny. I didn't actually listen to Taking Back Sunday at all until like a year into that band. And then like I was over at our guitarist's house and he started playing me some of their stuff. I'm like, wait a minute, this sounds exactly like what we do. What have you done? I got into heavier music. Actually, weirdly, we hosted a Japanese exchange student when I was probably like 12. It was in high school, but he stayed at our house because my mom was involved with the school. And he came through with a bunch of CDs of like these Japanese punk metal. It was new metal, basically. But he burned me copies of these CDs. And so that was like my first exposure to like that kind of like heavy music. And I was in. Immediately. I had no idea what they were saying. It was all in Japanese except for like, you know, the token couple of English words that they throw in there to sound cool. I was fully in. And then when I went to public school, so I did like an alternative elementary program until 7th grade. And so it wasn't working out for me by middle school for similar reasons, probably the depression stuff. And I was transferred back into public school. And the friends I fell in with were like, you know, the goths and the juggalos and stuff like that, because they seemed weirdos and I'm a weirdo. So it worked out. But when I told them I had no idea who like Slipknot was or whatever, they took deep offense to that and immediately burned me a mix CD. And I'm so eternally grateful for that, because they didn't need to, but they wanted to, I mean, I guess like indoctrinate me, really.
Yeah. There's that whole idea of these weirdos that want to show other people what they're dealing with and what they represent for themselves, and then doing that through music. And whether that's Japanese punk and metal, or whether it's, you know, something more mainstream like Slipknot, or in a lot of cases, you know, the punk side.
Looking back, it wasn't huge for me, but it was like, oh, this is the first time I've heard music like this.
Yeah.
Besides a Primus record my uncle got me or something like that, that I connected with on like a deeper level than that.
When did the depression that you lived with present itself in a tangible way, in the sense that you knew, wait a second, this isn't just me being sad. This isn't just me having some struggles or feeling angst. This is an actual capital D depression.
Yeah, well, it was when I was 16 and I was in that first band, that like Taking Back Sunday band. I was removed from that band by my mom for pretty good reason. She found weed in my room and was like, oh, those kids you were hanging out with, you can't see them anymore. Or like can't be in that band anymore. And she had good reason to do that. In hindsight, it was a bit extreme considering. But at the time, I was doing community college in high school. Because of our state, we had a program where you could do that. I chose to go to a community college a full ferry ride away from where I lived. So I'd be spending 8 hours on the other side of the water, north of Seattle. And overnight, effectively, like, cut off from, like, my friends and my support group in a way that was really fundamentally challenging. Because, like, when you're 16 and you're in community college, you're around people who are anywhere from 18 to 40, and opportunities for making that community are pretty slim, especially if you don't, you know, this is your first time doing anything quite like that. And so, like, I had a couple of friends there, but they were all much older than me. And so it was like hanging out with them was kind of weird. They were like, okay, like, this is like a child I'm hanging out with. That isolation really messed me up. And I basically, like, dropped out of school. I, like, dropped out of everything. I was struggling to just, like, function. Yeah, I dropped out of school. I failed my classes. I did all this stuff. Like, the only classes I didn't fail were the music classes because that felt good to me. But I couldn't put my finger on, like, what was going on. And eventually, like, it all came to a head where it was, like, impossible to hide from my mom that I was dropping out of school effectively. And I think that's when she recognized that it was a real problem. I think she thought, which is a fair assumption, that I was just being an angsty teenager. But yeah, she took me in for an evaluation and they were like, oh yeah, you were absolutely in the throes of a major depression right now. And that was kind of it. Like, it is kind of funny that, like, the absence of music is what, like, triggered the first of a series of major depressive episodes.
How did that depression look? You mentioned withdrawing and isolating yourself, but I think a lot of people, the message is, if you're dealing with depression or other mental health conditions, that you need to reach out, that you need to make sure that people know about it. And I think that puts the onus too much on the person dealing with the condition rather than the people around them. And as a society or as a people, we have to reach out to folks that are, and you can tell, like, someone's feeling, whether they're just, like, really tired or fatigued. I mean, it doesn't hurt to ask and kind of get into that a bit more. So How did that look for you? Because you said, you know, your mom was able to take you to get evaluated. Like, were you able to reach out or did they come to you? Or?
Yeah, how it presented was finding ways to not do the things I was supposed to do. There were certain things that I couldn't escape from, like, because I lived pretty remote, like, out in the woods. I still had to get a ride out to the ferry to go to school. Couldn't avoid that, so I was basically just, like, shuttled off to the other side of the water, and I would spend, rather than going to class and doing the work, I would just be in the library, like, listening to music and just, like, being a vegetable for, like, 8 hours until I had to come home, which is a rough existence. It's not a great feeling, but when you don't have the motivation or you don't feel like there's a point in, like, doing other things, it's hard to do that. So, like, the way it manifests is putting my time and energy into things that don't matter at all. I know they don't matter. And it's like a procrastination technique of sorts of, I know I need to do this thing, but I don't have the energy to do it. So I'm going to do the thing that I do have energy for, which is not the thing I should be doing. And the hard part is realizing that, like, oh, the things that would be helpful to me, like pursuing more creative stuff, making some music or doing other things that I know would be, like, helpful to me in recovering or managing the chemical imbalance in my brain, also feels like doing a disservice to the thing that I should be doing. Like, you know, the thing that my brain is like, I should be doing school. I should be doing X, Y, and Z, but, like, I can't right now. But, like, I shouldn't reward myself, big air quotes, with a thing that would be helping my mental health. And, like, obviously at 16, I didn't have the words to describe that. But, like, in my 30s, I do. The things that would help me with my mental health, which is, like, finding that sense of fulfillment, that feels like cheating. Like, that feels like a reward, quote unquote, for bad behavior. And so I do the middle thing, which is, like, reading magazines or playing video games or whatever.
That really speaks to me. I live with bipolar, so I have the depression and the manic sides, the up and downs. When I am feeling depressed, having an episode of depression, all the things that I love doing are no longer worth doing. Mm-hmm. I have no worth. I don't feel like I'm good at the things that I'm doing. So easier to shut away. And those things do creep up, you know, those time wasters. Even for me keeping busy and doing stuff with my hands, you know, like rearranging my CDs for the day, but then at the end of the day, I'm like, why did I even do that? Like, I didn't have to do that. So I think it is a situation where my brain's not able to function in a way that is able to do the things I want to do. I kind of default to stuff that I know I can do, but maybe at the end of the day, I just don't feel particularly good about it.
Yeah, I think a component to that is, like, societal expectations, right? Just being an adult and existing in the world is, like, a constant barrage of to-do lists of varying importance that are constantly in flux. There's no rhyme or reason to it sometimes. Like, what is important today is not going to be important tomorrow, but you won't really be able to plan for that or prepare for that. Those societal expectations don't really account for, like, what is good for your stability or healing. The things that make me fulfilled, like, right now, it would be, like, making some music, but, like opening up my DAW and, like, just writing something really fast. But I feel, like, an expectation to, like, I need to do my laundry, I need to do X, Y, like, you know, I need to do school. I mean, I'm still in school. I need to do, like, my homework, I need to walk the dog, whatever. And finding the space to accept both as being vital is really difficult. And I think we don't talk about that enough, that, like, taking good care of your mental health is also doing the things that make you happy. And, like, that's part of being an adult and part of being a well-rounded adult.
Yeah.
I think that visibility is happening more and more. Like, I'm seeing a lot more of that, like, taking a mental health day as being a thing that is acceptable more. At my work, in our sick day policy, it says, like, mental health days are totally okay to call out for and, like, use your sick time on, which is, like, wild. That was not a thing when I was 20.
Yeah. You're inspiring me with this idea of being able to do things that you want to and almost conjuring up things that have to be done on the to-do list, expectations of this and that with work and school, and it shouldn't be all consuming. And I think that if we can put aside, like you said, some time to do things, even like an hour a day to be creative, that can make a huge difference.
Yeah. And I don't know, like, I know the way my brain operates is best under structure, which is why I went back to public school. I think, like, having an hour a day is, like, a good way of going about it. And sometimes it's really, really hard to even, like, conceptualize a free hour in the day when you are so busy just trying to survive. I'm still struggling with that, like, to this day. That struggle is real, but, like, when you can find that time, it's really useful. And even if, I don't know, the hard thing is just the guilt around taking time for yourself when you should be, again, big air quotes, doing other things. Because there is, like, a guilt to it for me. And I don't know if that's, like, universal. Like, maybe you can elucidate on that. But that seems like a thing, like, especially in American society, of, like, you should be working until you die.
Yeah. Well, they call it shoulding yourself. I've heard that right. A lot. And it's always about the shoulds and the coulds. And so shoulding yourself. So there were... You can use that if you want.
Yeah, I think my mom's even said that.
How does your depression present itself now compared to when you first were diagnosed or what you lived through in the 20s? You know, maybe you're settling into it now you're in your 30s.
Yeah, I haven't been medicated for it since I was a teenager because it just never felt like it was doing much for me, which could be for a variety of reasons. Brain chemistry is really complicated. My relationship with it now is I think I have an understanding with it where when I'm in a pretty intense episode of it, I'm a lot more aware of it. It's a pattern, right? And these things kind of come in waves, and there are signs that it's happening and there are signs that it's coming, but there aren't really signs that it's gone. When you feel it coming, I've been able to, like, kind of mentally prepare myself for, like, okay, I'm going to have, like, a rough couple of weeks, but it's going to be fine. And then when I'm in it, I just keep saying, like, look, man, just make it to the next day, just one day at a time. One day at a time, do, like, a little thing that gives you a little hit of dopamine right now, and cuddle your dog, and then get to the next day, and the next day, and then it's fine. Or you don't even notice that it's fine anymore, but you're not in that as much. And that's just kind of how it's been. And it goes on and off every handful of months, but it's been like that since, you know, I was 16. And every time it comes, I just have better tools and more resilience for getting through those valleys so I can enjoy the peaks when they come.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for me, when a depression comes on, the first thing I notice is a little bit of physical stuff that you might associate with a flu or cold in some ways, you know, headache, sore muscles, and then into some thoughts, some what I called skewed thinking, thoughts I wouldn't normally have, negative thoughts about myself, negative thoughts about my world. And then if I can catch it at that stage and at least recognize it, then I can usually stabilize. But when I was first diagnosed and my moods were very, very swing, like way low, way high, I wasn't able to recognize that it was going on. So by the time I realized, holy cow, this isn't me, I was already too deep in it, and I couldn't pull myself back out in the same way.
Well, and then it starts affecting the people around you too. I think that's the hard part about it is, especially when you don't know what's going on, you just feel like this immense weight, and every single thing takes so much more energy, and you don't know why, and you can't explain it to anybody around you, and like you almost can't blame them for like losing their patience at a certain point. It's really tough, and like that's why I'm so glad that I have the tool set that I have after going through it so many times, to where like I'm able to I guess mask it is a weird way of saying it, but like I'm able to blunt the edges of how intense it can be, to where it's not affecting my relationships with people anymore. Or I can recognize that when my illness is impacting other people, I can be proactive in apologizing for it, which helps a lot. I think being honest with somebody, being, hey, I didn't mean to say something like that in that way. I see how that could be been upsetting. That's not how I actually feel. I'm just going through it right now. Sometimes just acknowledging fault can be really helpful in maintaining those relationships when you're going through it. But like, again, like recognizing it is really half the battle. If you can recognize in yourself when things are changing in ways that you shouldn't be, ways that aren't normal, you can take steps to like mitigate, like sandbagging your garage when it's about to flood or whatever.
And my relationship with myself as well. That can be really turbulent, and I can be treating myself really poorly.
Forgiving yourself too is a huge part of it, especially understanding that it won't be forever. Giving yourself that grace to have those moments of today just ain't it, you know? And being able to be like, okay, that's okay, because maybe tomorrow will be. And continuing on from there rather than like wallowing's a weird word to me. Being in that self-defeating place, you can't help your brain chemistry being imbalanced. Sometimes you can, sure, I guess, if you're eating right or whatever, but like some stuff's out of your control, and you have to just accept that and find ways to live with that and not beat yourself up over things that you don't have a hand in.
So, in those periods where you are not being creative for whatever reason in the past, in the future, what's your strategy there? How do you make sure that you're not going to fall back into that pit of, oh my God, I have nothing? Like, I have nothing. I don't have the music. I don't have the creativity.
Well, I mean, I have those pretty frequently. I'll go through 3 or 4 months of complete writer's block where like nothing sounds good. Nothing I play feels right or like resonates with me. I can get in my head about it for sure. That does affect me for a bit, or just like, have I lost it? Have I lost my ability to be creative or make music? And I keep, this has been happening for a couple years now, and it's been worse when I don't have a band because I don't have anyone anywhere to put it. But like when I'm still like in a band, we still have songs to play. We have 18 songs we can play. It's fine. I don't need to write 10 more right now. That takes the pressure off to a certain degree. But like I don't know. I've just been opening up a project file and playing some guitar and just seeing where that takes me. And if I don't like it, whatever, like no harm, no foul. Try and keep the muscle of it going, because I think like creativity is a muscle in the same way that doing lifts is. If you keep doing it, it's easier to find that space. And if you stop or like let yourself kind of like stop, like that muscle sort of atrophies. I wouldn't say like atrophies in the sense that like you can't get it back, but it's definitely harder to get back into it. And so like finding ways to stay consistent with just attempting creativity and being okay with not everything's going to be good all the time. And being okay with like this riff sucks, or like this drum part is weird, or like I hate this synth tone, what am I doing here? And being okay with just like letting it go and giving it goofy file names so you have no idea what it is later.
That was my conversation with Hank Atherton of Male Gaze, malegazeband.bandcamp.com. For more episodes of Screen Therapy, go to screentherapyhq.com or wherever you listen to podcasts. Big news, the Screen Therapy book is available now. Screen Therapy, A Punk Journey Through Mental Health, tells my story and the stories of others who use punk as a catalyst for mental health. Like this podcast, it links the community-minded punk scene with the mental wellness of the punks who belong to it. To order the book, go to screentherapyhq.com. For merch, check out screentherapy.threadless.com. Okay, enough promoting. It's time for some thanking. Thank you for listening to Screen Therapy. Doing this podcast and talking to folks about punk rock and mental health has been a crucial part of my own mental stability, and it means so much to me that you're out there listening. Screen Therapy is created in the Cathet region of coastal British Columbia, Canada, on the traditional territory of the Klahaman Nation. Contact me at screentherapyhq.com or email me at screentherapypodcast@gmail.com. I'd love to hear from you. Let's talk about punk rock and mental health. Until next time, take care and be well.
You're listening to CJSF at 90.1 FM in Burnaby. CJSF is diverse, independent, and yours, sharing music and voices from genres and cultures around the world, reflecting you and the rest of your community. You make CJSF diverse.
Is Bird Note. Ray Youngbear is a writer, musician, and a member of Meskwaki Nation. He considers himself a word collector, writing poetry in both English and Meskwaki, his first language. And he enjoys taking photos of the birds around his home in Iowa. In the spring of 2021, he was spending time with his grandson, Ozzy Youngbear.
We were watching robins around this time, and I just began composing a song based on us watching the robins as they hunted for earthworms. More than anything, to entertain my grandson, to try and coincide the hopping movements of the robin with the song itself. The English translation is Robin. Robin, our grandson enjoys watching you hunt for earthworms, hunt for earthworms.
Ray Youngbear later recorded the song for a music collection called For the Birds, the Birdsong Project. Over 200 musicians, artists, and writers contributed, with proceeds going to the National Audubon Society. Find a link to Ray Youngbear's song and the complete music collection on our website, birdnote.org. I'm Michael Stein.
Get ready for Listen Up. The Geography Student Union presents a night of live music starting at 5 p.m. on November 29th at the Student Union Building Ballroom on SFU Burnaby campus, featuring Sleepy Gonzalez, The Lunchtime Band, and Tiger Really. Tickets are $15, available online or at the door while they last, open to all ages and everyone.
The Sexual Violence Support and Prevention Office, SVSPO, offers confidential support, advice, and referrals to SFU and FIC community members, including students, staff, and faculty, who have been impacted by sexual violence and misconduct. The SVSPO is a welcoming place where you can access support without judgment or assumptions. We work from a survivor-centered perspective, using an empowerment and trauma-informed approach that considers individual situations and perspectives. Please reach out. Services are located at the Diamond Alumni Center, room 014 on the lower level. Please reach out by email at sv-support@sfu.ca. That was sv-support@sfu.ca.